contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Step on side to side. Body's gently moving. I let myself fly these times. Thanks for miles and miles. Crowd's been slow.
Jim Cook, really good. Everything Camel Fat is putting out, I'm grabbing and putting in rotation. Rich Migliori joining us, top of hour two on this Monday. Mig, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. I'm a tad out of breath. I had to run downstairs, literally on the perfect timing. It's Mardi Gras, it seems, in this house now for a second week, because after Ben Bacik sent us a Randazzo's king cake last week, another king cake has shown up. This one from Gambino's, which is the arch rival of Randazzo. So I guess we're gonna have we'll have a king cake throwdown.
That's fantastic.
FedEx guy. I guess it was supposed to have been here, I guess, Friday. So it got delayed somewhere. And in fact, Tina was getting a little. She was getting a little. I'd gotten a delivery notice, and I said, "Oh, there's another king cake coming." So by Saturday, she was like, "Where's that king cake?" I said, "It looks like it's in Mississippi."
Yeah, you know what? It's been crazy. Like my daughter needed a new phone, and it's like lost someplace. Like they, you know, deliveries are all messed up because of the weather all over the place, and she really needs it because they have horses at the farm near West Palm, and then horses at the showgrounds. And when her boss needs her, like, to run to the showgrounds to do something, and her phone is gone kaput or whatever. But anyway, it's nuts. And you talk about throwdowns. Carmella was cooking all day yesterday. I got home. She had made a chicken pot pie soup, which I'm going to have for lunch today.
Ooh.
Yeah. And like, biscuits, so, like, you don't have like, pot pie, we get the biscuits with it. And then she made I love her eggplant parm because she does it. It comes out really light and obviously very tasty. But so I tweeted a photo, and Chad Brown, he threw down the gauntlet. He's like, "All right, Carmella's eggplant parm against my mom's eggplant parm this summer. So we're in. We're doing it."
Well, wait. But you're soft pedaling. Chad's response, because he said, I'm going to have to paraphrase. He said that his mothers would dunk on Carmella's.
Yeah, he said that, but that's good because I like when people are overconfident. Hey, either way, it means you're going to eat good food.
Well, let me tell you, I may have to bring in a ringer here. And my man, Donnie Tessitore.
Okay.
Donnie, with what he does with an eggplant parm, you know, for those that used to come to the barbecue on Sundays when we would have the Sunday dinner, essentially, that you know, Donnie would do about 75% of the food, and I would do about 25%. And his what he does with eggplant, and I'm not a big eggplant parm fan.
Right.
My mother loved it. And I probably don't like it. I don't know if it's because of the texture. It's because it's such a pain in the ass to make.
It's labor intensive. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy.
If you're going to do it right, it's labor intensive. Yeah. But well, you don't. I'll give you a dish that is so simple and so good. And if you want, you could put eggplant in it, or you could put zucchini. But if get good ripe tomatoes, slice them. Olive oil, salt, and pepper on a baking sheet. A little dollop of tomato paste on each tomato slice.
Hmm.
A nice sweet onion. Slice the onion. A little olive oil, salt, and pepper. Bake it in the oven about 420, 25 minutes. Get a nice rotini going. Hmm. Once the tomatoes and onions are baked off, put them on a cutting board. Give them a rough chop. Toss them with your pasta, a little fresh basil, Reggiano Parmesan, or maybe even a little ricotta if you like it. And sometimes, like this time of year, for making it a little hearty, I'll dice up eggplant and roast the eggplant and then, toss it with my pasta. But it comes out as good as anything you're going to do with pasta, like, without cooking the sauce all day long like a real Sunday
sure.
gravy. But like in the summer when our garden's going, I get home from Belmont or something, I'll go out, pick a couple tomatoes, you've got the fresh herbs. I'll make a quick summer pasta like that. It can't come out better. Believe me, you love it. It's easy.
Well, it's like a rustica, as they call it. What Donnie would do, I had never seen it in an eggplant parm until he started bringing it to our thing on Sundays in the backyard. He cuts the eggplant. He stands the eggplant up, Rich.
Okay.
He doesn't cut rounds. He cuts planks the long way.
Yeah. I've seen that. That's good like that.
He puts it into a half pan, into a professional chef half pan, and it might be as much as eight or nine layers deep with his sauce. And with cheese, and it's literally, it's got to be 4 to 5 inches high when it's cut out. When you cut out a slice there was a big feature actually in New York Magazine too about lasagnas during pandemic has become a big thing in New York. For years, the best Italian restaurants wouldn't even go near lasagna, but it's had a big renaissance during. But it comes out lasagna high, and there's people listening.
Like eggplant parm lasagna, that's good takeout stuff. Like that's stuff that reheats well. And with the pandemic, like Carmela's mom made the most incredible lasagna, and she's been trying to make it as good as her mom. She's not quite there, but like she's on a mission to make it as good as her mom did.
Well, for those that are listening, and there's some people smiling listening in the Capital District who know Donnie and Laurie Tessitore and the Tessitore family. They had the famous luncheonette. His parents, DeCoco's,
for years
in Schenectady.
I'm telling you, Steve, we got to do it one of these days.
I know.
Right.
I'll make you my lasagna, which is with little meatballs. I make up like 120 little meatballs.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yep.
I will do a throwdown with anybody with Carmela's meatballs. She'll take on Bobby Flay with her meatballs. I would be confident that Carmela's meatballs will take on anybody, and she's got a whole process. She disinfects the whole granite countertop. She rolls them out. She's got like 100 meatballs. Yeah. She got a pot of gravy going that you could bathe a 3-year-old in. It's unbelievable. I mean, they come out so moist and so good. Now I'm hungry. Look what you did.
Well, this is not unusual for this, for, you know, for me, for any of our the regular visits. We go careening into the food arena. We'll revisit. I want to get into a couple of different things too with you, and last night I asked you if you had had a chance to hear Tony, and I know you hadn't, but there was a parade of names, Rich, that I'm anxious for you to hear that segment with him, because he brought up names that nobody hears.
I didn't get to listen either. Do you remember the names? I wanted to listen last night. I just got tied up with so much other stuff.
Well, it all came. If you saw the tweet I put out with his winning the John Campbell, and we ended up inadvertently kind of going through the chart, because it was a chart of like old time, you know, classic, you know, participation, whether it came from the horn, and then it actually triggered Haskins started off because it included Pete Moss. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. And it kind of went careening, you know, out into the netherworld. And I'm just looking here for the, and your name came up too, because there were a couple of horses. I know I saved the charts too. They're here on they're buried here on the desk somewhere. But it was quite something. And you know, Tony, I hadn't had a chance to talk to Tony in 2 weeks. So he was into the bit.
Yeah, he was chomping at the bit. He was ready to go. Great.
Very much. So he was a bit of a runoff, but we had a lot of fun. And oh, for goodness sakes, here it is. Well, there's the here we go. my man Neil from Clinton Street, the baking company. Yeah, he's saying, I thought this was where's the racing? Except when he's on, we do our Thanksgiving conversations with him. So that he's not one to talk.
He's great. I love that guy. He's so good. He's so cool.
Yeah, he is. Well, Bill Passmore came up.
Bill Passmore. Wow, Mr. Passmore.
And Nemetti.
Nemetti, he won the Meadowlands Cup on Princelet for John Campa.
Right, and ended up paralyzed, right? Ended up
in
a wheelchair.
Car accident. Yeah.
Yes.
What a shame. And then he worked in the racing office at Naira for a number of years.
Yes.
And he's Mike Luzzi's uncle through marriage.
Really?
And then, you know, Mike's grandfather, oh God, it's going to escape me, was the trainer of Greek Money who won the Preakness. And I can't believe his name's escaping me at the moment. But tremendous horse trainer. Used to winter in Aiken or Camden, South Carolina. So Mike comes from a, you know, that background, you know, good horse family. I remember I had the bug when Princelet was running in the Meadowlands Cup and got in with like 110 pounds. And they didn't think Nemetti was going to be able to, you know, do 112, and Mr. Campo was only going to take 2 pounds overweight. And he had been doing like 14 or 15, and I was like the standby. If he couldn't do 112, I was going to ride him. And I was chomping at the bit, and he got under. He made the weight, and the horse won by a neck.
I'm just looking at his, he had four graded stake wins. before his career was cut short. And actually, he won a graded stake on that Majesty's Prince too. He won the Lamplighter. You know, Tony won the Campbell when it was a grade two.
Wow. And you know, you talk about Mr. Passmore. He's tried a horse, I think his name is 38 Paces. He won the Campbell, won a bunch of races in Maryland. But you want to talk about riders, Vince Bracciali, you know, Mr. Passmore, you know, the riders in Maryland. Greg McCarron was, you know, part of that group. You know, they ruled over there. Bracciali was so patient. He would get horses to melt into his hands and drop out and come with this run, like, really world-class rider. Could have went anywhere and rode, you know, chose to settle down in Maryland. But he rode Ruffian twice when Jacinto couldn't ride her when he was suspended.
By the way, Harry Rice just pitching in here. You're trying to think of Buddy Raines.
Buddy Raines. That's what I couldn't come up with it, man. Thank you, Harry. Harry, you know, it's like basically I grew up with Harry. You know, Harry's dad was a Pinkerton at Naira. They, you know, was in the jocks room. Harry started working in the jocks room. He would, the Brook Tavern, Harry and his dad would live upstairs. It was like a boarding house, and they had rooms right across the street above the Brook Tavern, what is now the Brook Tavern. It wasn't the Brook Tavern then. You know, so I've known Harry since I'm a kid, you know, getting in the jocks room. We're a couple of years apart. So, and then watching his son, Harry, he worked with us with the productions for you know, America's Day at the Races. And, you know, it's just crazy. I mean, watching Mike's Luzzy's son, Lane, you know, the other night I was watching races from, you know, a couple weeks ago, actually, from Texas. And he, you know, watch him win a race. Yeah, the McCarthy, Trevor McCarthy, rode with his dad. Watching him ride is like watching a spitting image of his dad, the Davises.
Yeah.
These were all kids I knew in diapers, you know, and, you know, they're making their mark in the game. So two things, I'm getting old and, you know, but it's fun to watch. It really is.
You know, one of the discoveries that I had down in Maryland, you know, when I put out those photos during Preakness Week, and that Luzzy, you know, started, you know, that was he was down there in the Mid Atlantic at the beginning of his career, and you know, which you know predates you know my heavy involvement, and I've got a. I'll send it to you. Maybe you've seen it over. I think I've put it up once or twice. And he looks like a baby. But I should really put it side by side with a picture of Lane. I'm sure they got the same look.
They look so much alike.
Yeah.
You know what's uncanny too is it's so many of these kids. Like Dylan really didn't see his dad ride much. You know, he was the youngest of the clan. Looks so much like his dad on a horse. It's crazy. And then Lane, the same thing with Mike. They look so much like their fathers on horses. It's uncanny. And you know, a lot of people don't remember this. And this speaks to opportunity and getting chances. And there's not a lot that separates a lot of good riders except for the horses they get to ride and the opportunity. But Edgar Prado and Mike Luzzy came here together the first time they both tried it. I think it was the winter of 89, maybe. Somewhere in there. But anyway, and Mike stuck, and Edgar didn't. And Edgar went back to Maryland and you know, dominated and crushed. And then Edgar came back. He was riding everything for John Kimmel. Like, you know, John had a bunch of horses at Fair Hill with Vinny DiPaolo. So Edgar was their go-to guy in Maryland, Delaware. Like, you know, they run a horse in the state, get mom if they'd be looking for Edgar. When I broke my arm so badly about a week before Saratoga, and, you know, me and John were rolling. I was fighting for lead and rider with Johnny Velasquez. John was fighting for lead and trainer, I think, with Todd. And we had so many good horses going to Saratoga, so many good two-year-olds. And John was like, you know, I can't get Bailey because he's with Mott. I can't get this guy. I can't get that guy. That's when they brought Edgar to New York when I was hurt. And he wound up being second leading rider in Saratoga and took off. And that's what, you know, the second time Edgar came was. And it wasn't that he wasn't good enough to stick the first time. It's about opportunity.
Yeah. No, I didn't realize that either about that Edgar. Right? Edgar, I knew Edgar had started there, but that they came together. Well, and you know, I don't actually just as you were talking, I Scotty Silver is trying to scare up Victor. Is supposed to join us, Victor Carrasco, this morning, and you know, that was one of the parts of the action down there that was really special. You know, here's somebody, Rich, that you can identify with, you know, that has had his career interrupted repeatedly, you know, right, it seemed, when, you know, when he was on the cusp of, you know, some big things. And it seems like, you know, it seems like there's, I don't want to call them star-crossed, but, and I don't know if it's a physical, you know, if there's certain, he's a quick healer, but it just seems like, There's certain guys that have had, you know, notorious bad luck when it comes to having the career, you know, stopped and you know, regaining momentum.
Well, and it's so hard too, because when you're out, those horses are going to run, and other guys ride them, and if they ride them well, they're going to keep them, and then it's, you know, it's a rebuilding process. So not only do you have to rebuild yourself physically, you've got to be strong enough to overcome it mentally, and then you've got to rebuild your business and prove to everybody that you're okay. Because, you know, everybody loves to pass judgment. If a guy comes back off an injury, doesn't win right away, oh, he's scared, he's not right, he's hurt. You know, they never take a look and go, well, wait, he just really hasn't gotten the greatest opportunities. I was always careful, as much as I didn't manage my career, which, you know, has become much more of a fashionable thing. If you look, especially the charts in the early 80s when I started, you know, the first race I rode was a maiden 25, and every top rider rode the race, where now, you know, guys that are at the, you know, top of the heap, they don't ride those kind. They kind of manage their careers more. That wasn't a thing back, you know. Angel would ride the, you know, $10,000 claimers, the $25,000 maidens, Georgie, everybody. If you were open, you rode. But the only time that I did manage my career was when I would be coming back off injury, because I watched the process and how many times people would get down on a guy if he didn't win right away. And I would go to Michael Hushin or John Kimmel or Bruce Levine with Roddy Valenti. Hey, guys, I need to ride one. Pete Ferriola, I need to ride a winner right away. And I might not ride for, you know, another week if I couldn't get the right one, but I wanted to come back winning. So you could just put that all to bed, put it to rest, put it behind you. People can't talk that nonsense. And I always thought that was so important. Where I didn't manage my career so well is, and, you know, me and Carmella have talked about this at length, because sometimes I do have a little bit, you know, I look back at it with a little bit of regret. If I was in the track kitchen at 6 o'clock in the morning and a guy that had four horses that, you know, I've known since, you know, I grew up at Belmont, and he says, hey, I have this filly that, you know, and this is a particular instance, I'm not going to bring a trainer's name up, but I think he had three horses, and he's like, Meg, my filly ran really well last time with this apprentice. I can't get a good rider. If you ride her, I know she can win. How can I say no? How can I say no? I can't. So, yeah, of course I'll ride her. Well, you know, she fell on top of me. I got all broken up. Cost me, a bunch of good horses. Cost me a Breeders' Cup win. You know, but like Carmella says, that's part of the reason why you were successful, because you would go out there and try that hard on a guy's horse that, you know, other guys maybe wouldn't ride. Go, well, you know, I don't want to take a shot at getting hurt on a cheap horse. So you've got to, I guess you've got to embrace who you are and what created your success. And I'll never say I was unlucky. I got hurt and banged up at inopportune times. But you know what, Steve? I got to ride almost 4,500 winners on the toughest circuit in the world and establish myself. You know, I was a little kid growing up looking at those Wood Memorial win pictures, you know, on the third floor at Aqueduct, and I'm on that wall. I'm the kid that was running around trying to get jockey's goggles, and then I was in the room with those guys. So, you know, yeah, maybe, you know, would have been a little different if I didn't get banged up at different periods of time, but I got to do it. You know, I mean, I honestly, I consider myself extremely lucky.
It's a certain mentality and just a desire, and it's not to say that careers that get derailed are influenced, by not having enough desire. I mean, there's very few occasions where, if somebody doesn't press on, I mean, it's because they're being told that, they're putting their mobility in danger, like you would have been, Ramon. How about Espo, Victor's brother, Jose Espinoza. Who had no interest in retiring, and they just would not clear him to come back. Raul Rojas didn't want his career to end. You want it to end on your terms.
But this is what I tell young riders, and because I do get frustrated at times. For every athlete, whether it's a jockey, there will be a last ride. For a baseball player, there will be a last at bat, right? The football player is the last play. Every athlete, there is a time when it ends. And you hope that it's when that person, and I'll be specific about riders, when a rider decides they've had enough. And, there are notable few that made that choice and stepped out when they felt like they had, certainly more than accomplished enough, but they were satisfied. And Jerry Bailey comes to mind, Pat Day comes to mind, Chris McCarron. The vast majority of jockeys do not get to make that choice. It's made for them. And I tell young riders, that's why you've got to love it. You've got to embrace it. Enjoy the process, but also be the very best you can be, because the day it's over, you can't go back and do it over. You can't say, damn, I wish I'd have worked harder. I wish I'd have put more into it. I wish I would have done it. It's over. And you owe it to yourself. That's the one thing that, as much as it took me a good year to kind of get over the hump with not being able to ride anymore. When I was first told you couldn't do it anymore, and I was, I kind of knew it was probably over, but when the doctor solidified that, I didn't care at that moment because I was just so hurt. I coming out of surgery, and I was so banged up that I was like, fine. 3 months later, when I started feeling better, then it hit me. I can't do that. No, this is nuts. I'm going to get third opinion, fourth opinion. I'm going to get an opinion that fits, my agenda. And obviously I couldn't do that. And it took me about a year from that point to get over the depression, that feeling of it's you've got to mourn it. You're losing something that has been your whole life. But the only reason that I think I was able to get past it is I know that I left it all out there. I left no stone unturned in my pursuit to be the best I could be. Now, was I the best? No, there were guys that could do things better than me. I think I was very good, but I know that I maximized my abilities. And, for a guy that was riding at probably 30 pounds under my natural weight, I was strong. I could finish. I think that I left it out there and people saw that. So at least I could look in the mirror and go, well, I did the best I could possibly do with the gifts that God gave me. Now, if I hadn't, and I don't think I would have still be over it. I think I would be living if that feeling of what I could have done, what I could have been. And that's why I try to preach to these young riders, don't put yourself in that position where you look back and you know that you could have been better than you are.
And as you were talking to and got into this area, Rich, Tony Black sent me a note and about, when, about when you get hurt and what it takes to get back, and that's a factor. And Tony Black joins. It's always fun when we put Tony together with Rich. Tony, hey.
Hey, Steve, it's always a pleasure. And Rich is one of my heroes. I really enjoyed listening to him. And when he was talking about getting hurt, and sometimes, you know, it's inopportune times, it just brought to mind the true love of the sport, lover of the sport, the true jockey that loves doing it every day. When you get hurt, you never think of, boy, is this going to happen again? I don't know if I want to do this. You think, how long is it going to take to get over this so I can get back to what I love to do? And that's the first thing that comes to mind when we talk about recovering from injury. And I'll never forget one time, not to go on too much because I enjoy listening to Rich. I had a doctor when I broke my back, T5, 6, 7, 8, 9. He says, you don't even have a T7 anymore. We're going to put a rod in your back, but first we got to get you in a brace and get you standing straight and get the swelling out. And he says, but this is it. You know, this is career ending. You won't ride anymore. And Kylie's sitting there crying, you know, because she's seeing them big paychecks fly out the window. And and I said, oh, well, you know, we'll see. He says, no, this isn't we'll see. This is it. It's out over, Tone. 5 months later, I was riding races. I never got the rod in my back. I wore the brace 24 hours a day, 24/7 for 3 months, and I hung upside down every night. And I never have a problem with my back. And he says, you don't even have a T7 anymore. It's crushed. But you know what? The true athlete, it's one thing that I can say for jockeys. They usually recover pretty good and pretty quick and pretty well because they're in such good shape. Jockeys are one of the fittest athletes out there. And Rich will attest to that fact.
I got to jump in here because, you know, jockeys know the jockeys that can really ride. I mean, a guy could be leading rider, and you know the guy seventh in the standings is a better rider. The riders know. And for me, the biggest compliment I can pay a rider is not to call them a jockey, call them a race rider. There are probably 1,600 licensed jockeys. I would say, generously, there's 50 to 100 race riders out of that. Tony Black was a stone race rider, pure race rider. You were not getting by him. And if you want any living proof, watch the Pennsylvania Derby when he takes Mike Smith to school. And if Mike's listening, I apologize, but Mike, Tony Black took you to school that day.
You know what? That's such a compliment. You don't know. My whole face is tingling with what you just said. Thank you so much, Richie. But you know what, Mike? This is the kind of guy Mike is. He came to ride the Pennsylvania Derby a few years ago. And he said, I wasn't even riding at the time. I walked into the rec room. He's telling a bunch of jocks, young kids, the story about the Pennsylvania Derby that he finished second on in formal gold. And he says, yeah, and here's the guy. I walked in the back door. He said, here's the guy. He pointed to me. I said, well, what guy? What are you talking about? He said, here's the guy that did to me what I'm used to doing to other riders. That's exactly what he said. And I thought, man, what a class act, you know.
Well, you say that. Mike's all class. All class. But I, you know, I can't tell you. You know, Tony would ship in. I remember I rode a horse for Kimmel one day and come up inside of Tony and put me in so tight. I couldn't go forward and I couldn't go backward. I was stuck. And I felt safe. Like I wasn't, like he wasn't going to drop me, but I was like in a cocoon. And I literally at the quarter pole finally was able to like back out of the spot. And I got up and beat you, but I was like, I was five lengths the best. And this guy had me. Eddie Maple was good at it, too. That puts you in so tight that literally you can't go forward. You're just stuck there. Incredible. And, you know, guys talk about race ride, and that's the art of race ride. And putting a guy in such a precarious position without putting them in danger and inhibiting their forward progress in just that riding into the line but not over it, to me, that's beautiful. And that's, again, Tony Black, race rider, not a jockey, race rider.
What a compliment. Thank you so much, Rich. You made my day. I don't even want to say day. You made days for me saying that because you know the respect I have for you. And, geez, thank you so much, Rich. That means a lot. You know, when we're done riding, like I kind of am, or I am, it means so much that some of the well-respected people and the people that you respected in this business think that much of you. And I really appreciate that. You don't know how much I really appreciate that. Thank you.
It's from the heart. We were talking, you know, last week about Ruben Hernandez, one of the strongest finishers ever with. I think never really got the credit he deserved. And you know, so many good riders over the year. Frankie Lovato was a tremendous rider. I mean,
right.
You know, and it comes down to opportunity, but making the most of those opportunities. And that's the other thing I tell young riders. You never know, like you can't control when you're going to get that shot, when you're going to get the opportunity on a really good horse. But the only thing you can control is being ready for the opportunity when it comes and making the most of it. So that means keeping yourself, your head in the game, keeping yourself fit, keeping yourself, you know, focused. And when you get that opportunity, then it's your responsibility to make the most of it. You know, you see guys that let down a little because they get discouraged, and then all of a sudden somebody took off or got hurt and they can pick up a horse, but they're just not as prepared as they should be. That's the only thing you can control is your preparation and your work ethic. You can't control if you're going to get that opportunity, but be ready for it when it comes.
And you know what, Rich, not just in horse racing, but in any sport, an athlete's going to have to endure ups and downs in the game. And the ups are easy to ride the wave. The downs are what test you to see if you've got the stay-to-itiveness to stick it out and recover and keep coming back till you get into one of those peak momentum cycles. But you are tested as a jockey. And like you were saying, there are inopportune times to get hurt, and sometimes you have very little control over them, and they can really interrupt your business, and the horses are going to be winning while you're not on them. And I think at times like, well, I broke Broad Brush's maiden, one allowance race on him, and then got hurt, never rode him after that. But they were inopportune injuries that, you know what? Broad Brush went on to win a lot of races, but I didn't put my head down and say, geez, look what I missed out on. I said, let me find another one. Maybe never found another one. But we wound up, you know, sticking it out. You, sticking it out, getting through the injuries, watching horses, and it's disheartening to watch horses win without you on them when you knew you had the opportunity to ride them if you were 100% in one piece. But this is a game that tests you, and probably more so than any other sport. It tests you at times where you're at your lowest. You're beat up, you're banged up, you're busted up. So it takes a strong person. You know, I have so much respect, and I always tell these kids, you know, ride that wave, ride the wave, but don't give up when it gets tough, brother. You got to keep plugging.
No, you have to, but that's the mindset, you know, to be a successful athlete, be successful in life. I'll tell you a quick story. So I was supposed to ride Artie Schiller in the Breeders' Cup about 4 days, 5 days before I break my leg in the paddock at Belmont. And got out of the hospital the day before the Breeders' Cup, and I had worked Artie Schiller actually the morning that I broke my leg. I had worked him and had called Carmella and said, oh, man, we're going to win the Breeders' Cup. He's doing unbelievable. And so I was down. I was really bummed out that, you know, I couldn't ride him. And I got a call from, I think ABC was doing the Breeders' Cup then. Would I come out to Belmont to do an interview? And I'm in a cast. I just got out of the hospital. And I'm like, I'm not going to Belmont. And I turned it down. I hung up. And my wife said to me, Carmella said to me, you know, you're always telling the boys that it's easy to be a good winner, but it's when things go against you, when things are tough, that's when you find out about your character and how you conduct yourself then. And she goes, you always talk about it. She says, you have an opportunity to show them, you know, and you can go out there and keep your head up. And it kind of hit me like I'm talking the talk, but I'm not walking the walk. So I called back and I said, listen, I'll come out and do the interview. My son, Joseph, was at the races with Christoph Clement and his family. Miguel and my son Joe are very good friends. I gave the interview in the paddock, talked about Artie Schiller, the trip he needs, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, okay, well, now we're going to mic you up. So, you know, we're going to film you watching the race. I said, no, I'm not. I agreed to do the interview. Oh, that's going too far. So I refused it. And I went down to the jockey's room to watch that race, the Breeders' Cup Mile. And I'm sitting there with Eddie Maple, who had retired not too long before that, and Artie Schiller wins. And, you know, Eddie was cool, and he's like, man, I'm sorry. And I said, listen, Eddie, we know the game. It happened to him with Conquistador Cielo and the Belmont. And as we're sitting there, Tom Hammond on ABC goes, oh, you have to feel for Richard McGleary. He was so upset that the horse won, he left the races. I'm like, what? I didn't leave the races. I don't want to be portrayed like that. I was so happy for the Entenmanns and the Walshes. I was super happy for Jimmy Jerkins, who another guy I basically grew up with. And I loved the horse. I don't want to be portrayed like that. So I went to go up to the third, fourth set to talk to Hammond. Like, hey, I'm here. I'm not, you know, that's not me. And I ran into my son on the way, and he was upset that the horse won without me. And I had to, you know, take care of my son and talk to him and, you know, make him understand that, you know, this is what I was talking about. This is when you get kicked in the head, how you react to it, how you deal with adversity. And I never did talk to Tom Hammond, and I'm sure it wasn't his fault. I'm sure that somebody told him that in his ear. Now, having done TV enough, you get information sometimes that isn't completely accurate. But, that was my story of the day that I, you know, I was like, I'm going to hide in my house, and I didn't, because my wife pointed out to me, hey, you talk this to the kids, but here you have an opportunity to show them. And, you know, at the end of the day, isn't that the most important thing, if you at least teach your kids the right way, right?
You walk the walk. You talk the talk. You got to walk the walk. Yeah, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Steve, but there's two stories, real quick ones. I was riding two nice horses, My Juliet and Candy Eclair. She was two-year-old champion, Eclipse Award winner, and My Juliet was sprint champion. Well, one day when I was supposed to go to fly to California on Saturday to ride My Juliet, my brother and I were riding day. I was riding day and night. He drove me one night back from the races. I think it was Penn National or wherever. And he hit a parked car. I went through the windshield of a car on Tuesday. I'm all stitched up. I have to fly to California on Friday night. I bleed the whole way out there, and I rode My Juliet. And she wins January 1st, the New Year's Day stake at Santa Anita, the San Flores, I think it was. And I thought to myself, boy, what a way to lose this mount if I didn't fly out here with a busted nose and 40 stitches in my mouth and everything else. The next time something happened, on Tuesday, I'm riding a horse at Keystone or wherever it was in 79. On Saturday, Candy Eclair is going to run in the Salima Stakes. She's one of the nicest two-year-old fillies in the country.
Great one.
I fall leaving the gate on Tuesday. I break my hand, the thumb. I broke it. Bones. I mean, I broke it. The doctor put a cast on it, and he said, you'll be off like 6-8 weeks. I said, yeah, we'll see about that. I cut the cast back, and I taped the thumb, and the bone is like sticking up against the skin. I tape it. Miss Paxson, the owner of the horse, says, am I going to need a rider? I says, nah. I says, I just dislocated it. They popped it back in. It's all right. She says, you're going to be all right to ride? I says, yeah, I'm riding Saturday to Salima. I get driven down to Laurel. I, get my license, get on her. And I says, man, I shouldn't even have to hit this filly. She's a running summer gun, and it's a mile 16th of the second wire, I believe this Lima was. Don't you know Doug Thomas come running up on the outside of me, and here, the one thing I don't want to do is reach down and crack her. I reach down, crack her, bang, bang, bang. She takes off again, wave the stick at her. She takes off again, and she wins the Salima. I said, man, what a way to lose a mount. You break a thumb leaving a gate. Is that BS? But I didn't lose the mount. But it was the idea. I wasn't going to lose it. When I got off of her, the bone was just about popped through the skin, and I went to the emergency ward, and the doctor, I'll never forget, he put his foot up on the examination thing, and he grabbed my thumb, and he said, I'm going to block your arm, and I'm going to put it back in place. You probably need operation. Never needed an operation. He put it in place. They casted it. I didn't ride for 6 weeks, and I was back to riding. But this is a game that tests an athlete's fortitude. And Richie's got a million stories, and I guess I got a million, too. But it's
only You brought up My Juliet, and I was riding a nice filly for Dickie Small, Tactile. I won the Gazelle on her when it was a grade one, and I won the Beldame on her. She won the Gazelle by a nose, the Beldame by a head. And then she went, you know, for a rest for the winter. And in May, I see she's on the work tab at Laurel, and she's nominated to the Shoe V when the Shoe V was a grade one. So I called up, you know, Dickie Small, and how's she doing? Oh, she's doing great. Are you going to run in the Shoe V? Yes. I said, should I tell my agent? He's, well, and now I'm 2-for-2 on the filly. I won 2 grade ones on it. He says, well, you know, Chris Antley's riding so well. We're going to let Chris ride her in the Shoe V. Oh. And I was like, you know, Richard, like, I'm 2 grade ones. I could, well, you know, no, we're just going to go with who we think's riding well right now. So I was upset, right? So Kieran McLaughlin was assistant to Wayne Lucas. And I'm going through the nominations because I want to ride this race. I want to be in this race. I want to make sure she has a hard time. And the only mount I can make is a daughter of My Juliet, a filly named Tis Juliet. She was by Allegory, right, out of My Juliet. And,
right.
But she gets in with 108 pounds. I'm tacking 14, and I'm killing myself to do 14. So I can't even get in the limit. And Kieran talked to Wayne and kind of lobbied for me to ride the filly. And he said, listen, you got to get in the limit, but could you do like 11 or 12? I think I did 111 on her. I killed myself. You know what? I wound up winning the Shoe V, and I beat Tactile, and she paid like $40.
Yeah, it's amazing. In My Juliet, she only had a few foals that were very useful, and that was the most useful foal that she had. What a great filly she was. And the only reason I got on her, My Juliet, not to change the subject off of your story, was because she had her ankle operated on. She had 2 screws in her cannon bone. That's what it was, her ankle, cannon bone, whatever. And I was the test pilot in the morning. And I was used as the test pilot to see if she was going to hold up. Gene used her at her. And I rode some horses for Gene. And since I was the test pilot in the morning, they said, well, you can ride her first time we run her. And the first time they ran her was at Keystone, and she just galloped and played with the whole field, and I never even moved on her. And then they said, well, you rode her good there. We'll let you ride her one more time. I wound up riding her, like, to the end of her career. and it was just strictly because I was a test pilot.
Didn't you beat both Forbes with her in the Vosburg?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in the Vosburg. And Angel claimed foul against me because I guess when he was on the inside, I wanted him to be on the outside. When he was on the outside, I kind of blocked him. But in a way that, you know, you can do it. You know, finesse, aggressiveness, but not crossing the line. Well, he claimed foul. And in fact, I'm looking at the chart right now because I got a picture of her on my wall. And they took him down and placed him third because leaving the gate, he eliminated a free tax or some horse in the race. I don't have the horse that finished third. He eliminated leaving the gate. He was second, and they placed him third. And I was lucky enough with My Juliet. She did everything perfect. She was a beautiful horse, right? But that's the luck of the draw sometimes. Like you were saying, you get on good horses, you look for good horses, you lose good horses, and you try to find others. And, you know, for being in a place like I was at Keystone, Philadelphia Park, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity. And you mentioned a hell of a trainer, Richard Small. I'll never forget the day he came to me, and he said, listen, we shipped this horse in to Keystone, Broadbrush. He said, throw out its first race. J.K. Adams rode her, and it was a learning experience, and he'll run much better today. Well, of course, he galloped. The next time I rode him, he galloped. He tried to bolt and galloped. And then I got busted up and lost the mount. But that's horse racing, Rich, ain't it?
Yeah, well, it is. And it's funny. The first time I met Gary Stevens was at the Ohio Derby. He was riding Broadbrush, and I was riding a horse for Howie Tesher, Bolshoi Boy. And it's funny because I've told Gary this now. I said, I didn't like you when I met you. I thought he was cocky. You know, I was like, so, I mean, we're friends now, but it's funny. Like, when I first met him, I was like, I don't like this guy at all. And then he's in front on Bolshoi, on Broadbrush of Dave Paul, and he propped and ducked out, and I blew by him. And I've got, like, a length with 50 yards to run, and he saw me, he took off, and he beat me. So then I really didn't like Gary.
But Broadbrush was a quirky individual. The only time he didn't do something wrong, I think, was his first start of his life was a learning experience. The second start, I rode him, and he won the third start of his life. I rode him back. Like I said, he tried bolting at the quarter pole. I got him in, and he just went and bloke. float on again and win. But then when he won the Pennsylvania Derby, Angel Cordero rode him. And he was on the lead at the head of the stretch, bolted so bad he dropped back to third or fourth and come down the outside fence and won anyway. I thought, man, I taught this son of a gun to do some bad things, I guess, after the second start of his, the second win I had on him. I must have taught him bad because he had some quirky habits and unpredictable, you know, like you said, he tried to prop and bolt and he did, and he did that with several times and overcame it because he was a big, powerful, beautiful horse.
One of the best races you'll ever see, and you can find it on YouTube, is Ferdinand and Broad Brush in the Santa Anita Handicap. Broad Brush beat him a nose. What a race. Oh, my gosh. That's one of my top five I've ever seen in my life.
Well, that's something, Rich. You got one hell of a memory. And
you guys are always remembering. You guys remember every single it's unbelievable.
But can't remember what I ate for dinner last night. How about that?
Nobody's asking about that.
Too many concussions along the way, I guess.
Tony, who was Robert Wright that rode Broad Brush after you had those two wins?
Oh, that was Danny Wright.
And that's Danny Wright, okay.
And I went to Merlin after Danny Wright rode him, and I recovered and I was riding down there. He says, hey, Tone, he says, I couldn't even let this son of a gun run down the stretch. He lugged in so bad. I said, lugged in? Danny told me this. I said, what do you mean he lugged in? He said, he lugged in so bad. I was, like, standing up on him to keep him from hitting the inside fence. And I said, well, he tried bolting with me the second time I rode him. He was a quirky individual. But he had a good teacher, a good trainer, Richard Small. And I'll never forget when I walked in the paddock at Keystone. He says, listen, Tone, don't even look at that first race. This horse is a runner. That was just a learning experience for him. I thought, phew. And he won for fun that day.
Well, it's nice that it goes on to win $2.6 million with legendary, and you know when he we should look for this. I'll ask Casey this week to find it when he died. I had Dickie. In fact, it might be in our best of page, and Dickie Small told the stories, Tony, and. Whenever you'd have Dickie Small on, Dickie would laugh at his own jokes or his own. There would be things that would come up, and he had the most infectious laugh, and he would start to laugh about what he was telling you, and he had just the greatest delivery, and you know, talking about putting Broad Brush on the van to make him think he was going somewhere because he loved the van. That's a great, and Dickie would laugh about it. Unbelievable.
Yeah, a lot of stories those guys could tell you. These guys, you don't want to call them old school or just old school horsemen, but they are a backbone of the business when it comes to teaching the young people that come along. If the young person pays attention to a guy like Dickie Small, you know, a guy like Richard Migliore, a guy that comes along and wants to learn something, ask questions and make sure you listen, because that's what us kids did, right, Rich? I mean, we asked questions. I started riding in 70, and there was an old rider named Chris Rogers, you know, and took me under his wing, and I'll never forget every conversation that I had with him. It started out, hey, kid, what are you trying to kill yourself? Hey, kid, I don't want to be behind you when you do something stupid like that again. But they taught you. Phil Grimm, Chris Rogers, guys like that. You accept Frank Lovato was an old rider, the old man. Then he'd been riding 9 or 10 years. If you listen to him, you learned. Right, Rich?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember one day I did something really dumb. Yeah, you know, I had the bug, and Eddie Maple yelled at me, and I was mortified, you know, because I knew I made a mistake. And the next day, we were in the same corner. We had the same valet. And the next day, I come in, and I'm looking to hide from him, you know. And he talked to me like normal. He just, you know, he kind of let me have it and taught me what I did wrong and didn't hold a grudge. And it was like opened my eyes, like, oh, yeah, okay, I can get mad at you for a minute and explain something to you, and then you move on. So there were so many, you know, great mentors. And you know, you walk in a room with riders of those caliber that, you know, like you say, Tony, pay attention, listen. And even, you know, earlier for me, coming up under contract with Steve DeMauro, you know, he really schooled me. Like, by the time I walked in the room to ride my first race, I was so prepared. I mean, obviously you have to do it, but they really took time when they put you under contract to bring you along right. The right way. Got to a point where you're working, you know, 5, 6, 8 horses every morning, getting the times right. And the whole process back then, Tony, I don't know, I imagine it was the same for you. I had to spend a week with the patrol judges at different points of the track. I had to spend a week at the starting gate with the starter. I had to, you know, meet with the stewards. I had to have 2 jockeys in good standing say that, you know, they kind of vouch for me. The outriders had to say I was okay. The starter had to say I was okay. It was a whole process that I don't see it as rigorous right now as it once was.
Yeah, and that's sad for the kids that are learning in this new process or lack of process that they have. When we were kids, I mean, in the 70s, we had to spend, quite a few days sitting behind the starting gate, watching what goes on. And, you know, guys like, I can't even remember some of the starters. it was Eddie Blind in Maryland, but in Pennsylvania, I think it was Frank Wright, or I forget who it was. But they made you go sit there. You didn't have to maybe go to the patrol judges, but you maybe had to come to movies. But the one thing the stewards did weigh in on, who was your contract holder? Is he well-respected and is he a good teacher? And a lot of things they might weigh because it says, well, yeah, C.P. Coco, that was a guy not maybe well-known, but an old first-class Jersey horseman. And they say, oh, CP's had you how many years? 3? You've been galloping horses for him? Yeah. I'm galloping horses and rubbing the pony, and I'm making $39 a week clear. So they put some weight in on who taught you, and they knew CP Coco rode some horses. He was still getting on horses then and training horses and always had 20 or 30 in Jersey. So they put weight in who taught you, and that was so important. And kids are missing out on not having contracts now, I think, even though so many of them maybe were abused because, you know, you had a contract employer, he owned you. Sometimes these kids got really messed around and just used. But more times than enough, they got taught. But when they abolished contracts and now just went to certificates and you weren't really connected. I had a 3-year contract with Charlie Coco. And last year I was still making $39 a week. And all of a sudden he puts me on my first horse at Wins. He puts me on 8 that week. 5 of them win and I made $1,200. But man, 1970, $1,200, that's like $12,000 to me. After making $39 a week clear.
I was making 90.
I was still rubbing the pony and catching stalls in the morning and galloping 10, 12, but $1,200, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, but that's why you're a horseman, though. You aren't just a jockey. You were a race rider, a horseman. It's funny looking back on it. There were times I know I was probably resentful and, you know, I got to go to the farm after working all morning and work at the farm and do this and do that. I'm so happy now that I had that experience because it definitely made me smarter, made me a horseman. And in 1980, I was making 90 a week, so I had it on.
Hey, you know what? I'll never forget it. I was riding races and winning, you know, like I said, the first week I rode, it was unheard of to start your bug. Ride 8 horses and start your bug the first week. June 15th, I started riding. June 20-something, I started my bug because I won my 5th race. But if I got done early that day, guess who rode the pony and took the next horses my contract employer had in? Tony Black took them until old man Palmer. Do you remember the old steward, old man Palmer?
Yes.
Mr. Palmer came down one day. He says, what are you doing on the pony? I says, oh, Charlie's got 2 horses in the 8th and 9th race. He says, you rode the first 2 races. He says, you don't pony horses in the last 2 because you got done the first 2. I said, Mr. Palmer, I do what I'm told. I'm under contract to Mr. Coco. You'll have to talk to him about that. I can't talk to him about that. And he went over to Charlie, and I'll never forget him sitting on the pony. He says, Charlie, you can't let this kid pony horses, ride horses and races, and then pony horses in the afternoon. He said, it looks bad to the public. He says, well, I ain't really interested in what it looks like to the public. He says, I run a business here. He says, well, then, Mr. Palmer, I'll never forget what he says. He says, well, you can take your business and tell your business that it ain't letting this jock bring horses to the gate anymore, and that's an order by the stewards. And that's the only way I got out of pony horses to the gate at Liberty Bell. It was Liberty Bell, 1970. I'll never forget it.
That's great. Tony, they sent me to Finger Lakes, me and Stevie Jr., who's now the steward at Gulfstream, Mr. DeMauro's son. We went to Finger Lakes with three horses from Saratoga after the Saratoga meet ended, and I was supposed to ride them. They were going to start me at Finger Lakes, and I had to break a filly out of the gate for the starter that we were getting okayed as well, and the starter turned to Stevie after I broke her and said, I'll let the filly run, but if that kid ever makes a rider, I'll be president of the United States. So we ran the three, two of them won, and the other was second, and we left them there, and we went home, and I started about a month later. A couple of years later, I went up, and I won the New York Oaks, and it was the same starter, and I'm walking through the tunnel, and he goes, hey, nice ride, little jock, and I said, thanks, Mr. President, and he didn't get it. He forgot about me.
It's amazing how this game teaches you a lot of humility, doesn't it, Richie? When you can dish it out, that's great. But when you have to take it, you better not act like it's tough to take it. And I always watch kids walk up in the jock's room, and the ones that, you know, come back after they've been used, and they come back with an open mind and a good attitude and don't sit there sulking in the middle of the jock's room or in the corner, these kids will make it. The one that comes back sulking or wants to, you know, get all upset and down and depressed, usually they're going to have a tough time of it. It's amazing. This game does teach you how to be an athlete and teaches you a lot of humility along the way.
Well said. Well said.
Am I supposed to jump in and stop this? Because nobody will be happy if I stop it. So
no, I'm enjoying it. I mean, yeah, it's a story. But you think about it. Like, we grew up in the jockey's room. I mean, you know, you're a kid on the track, but then you get in the room, and, you know, I felt like I was always very fortunate because, you know, I paid attention to all of these tremendous riders and how they conducted themselves, how they prepared. You know, even to the point, like, when I started making a little money, dressing a certain way, going to the jockey's room. And Eddie Maple was great about that because I would get, you know, I would be a bit mercurial. Like, if something happened, I might lose my temper. And Eddie one day pulled me aside and said, you know, if you won five today, what are you going to do tomorrow morning? I said, well, I'll be at the track early, get on horses. And he goes, okay, and if you got beat on five favorites, what are you going to do tomorrow morning? I said, get up early, be at the track, get on horse. He goes, so why are you going up and down so much? Just stay even. And, I mean, they called him Steady Eddie for a reason. And he was, you know, a great influence on me, my attitude, how I approach things. You know, I never quite as calm as he could be, but he definitely was a great role model. Angel was a great role model, Cordero, because you had to show up with your A game every day. Otherwise, he was going to exploit you, and it made you be a better rider. You had to be at your best. Georgie Velasquez, so much class and timing, the way he would do things, and you'd pay attention to what part of the track he was on because that usually was the place you wanted to be. Just so many, one after another after another. And I always tell people, like, say, well, it had to be tough, you know, competing at that level when you were starting. You know what? It was the greatest thing because if you couldn't learn to be a good rider riding with those guys, well, then you just had no ability because it, just riding with them, things were going to rub off and you were going to learn, you know, the little tricks and the little different things they did. And again, just what you're saying, paying attention. If you pay attention, and, you know, when I was teaching the apprentice jockey program, you always get some kids that want to tell you what's what. And the only thing I say to them is the one that's talking is not learning. When you're listening, you're learning. When you're talking, you're not learning.
And a lot of times when you see the kid, he wants to give you an excuse, and you know the excuse because you've been there before. They want to give you an excuse why they did a certain thing, and instead of saying, oh, okay, I shouldn't have done that. And you were so fortunate, and that's why you're a race rider, to come around guys like you were saying, Cordero, Velasquez, Vasquez, those guys, and Betty Maple, you know. And you had a group of riders in New York of that caliber. And if you were the kind of kid that listened and showed that you were appreciative of their advice and not sulking from it, you learned. And in Jersey, we had guys like Walter Blum, I'll never forget, Phil Grimm, Frank Lovato, you know, guys like that, that were willing to teach you if you didn't put your head down and sulk and you listened. And Walter Blum, I'll never forget, one day I was riding his horse and they took me off. They put Walter on him. I says, Walter, I can't get this horse out of the gate. And, you know, and he says, yeah, well, I've watched you in the gate. He says, you know, take a handful of mane, sit chilly, shut up. Just shut up and stay quiet. And I says, well, I just want to let you know this horse is really fractious in the gate, you know. He says, yeah. He says, well, you should have told the man to stand him. I says, well, they don't listen to me. I'm a bug boy. He says, I better be on the lead today. He said, don't you know, Busy Baba was the horse. I'll never forget it. It's funny how you, some claimer, right? And you remember the name of the horse because some guy like Walter Blum said, he'll be out of the gate all right today. And he might even run good. Well, you got him out of the gate. He's on the lead and he won. And you learned. You didn't put your head down and sulk. You said, you know, maybe I got to watch Walter more. You know, he gets these, he's a front-running jock. Or he's a good gate man. Maybe I got to copy a guy like that, you know? And that's what you did. And there was riders that were Paul Kaly. There's a name from the past, you know? Guys like that. You had to sit and watch them and open your eyes. And like you said, Rich, shut your mouth. Open your eyes and shut your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I was riding a bunch of horses from Mitchell Griffin, had Fred Hooper's horses, and they were stabled in Saratoga when they first reopened Saratoga for training in the spring. And I would drive up on Monday night, because we used to race Mondays, only day off was Tuesday. I would drive up Monday night, and I'd get on horses for them Tuesday morning in Saratoga. And we ran the first two-year-old, a horse named Cantabile, won and paid like $40. He ran another filly, Flying Midnight, she won, paid like $17. We ran the third one, horse named Copalon, wound up being two-year-old champion, and he won and paid like $8. People were catching on that, you know, something was going on up in Saratoga when before it was in fashion to be there in the spring. And I got beat on a horse named Academy Age. Now, I was like maybe 18 years old. And Mitchell Griffin, I went up to work horses, and he said, listen, Mr. Hooper's going to take you off all of these horses. He's mad that horse got beat. And I'm like, well, we're like 3 for 4. I mean, you know. And he said, well, he goes, he's bringing in some jock from that's been riding in Chicago, and he's going to ride all the horses. So a couple days later, I'm at Belmont, and I see Mr. Hooper coming out of the racing office. And I went up to him. I said, Mr. Hooper, I said, you know, I'm Richie McGuire. I've been riding your horse. He goes, oh, I know who you are. And I said, well, sir, Mr. Griffin told me you're taking me off all the horses. I said, and sir, I've been driving up to Saratoga to work them every week. I'm getting on 8-10 horses every Tuesday for you, and I don't think that's fair. And he goes, well, I got a jock I'm bringing in from Chicago who's going to ride all my horses. And I said, but, sir, could you just leave me on the ones I won on at least? You know, I want Copalon. And he goes, no, I'm going to use this jock that I'm bringing from Chicago. I said, sir, that's not fair. I got, like, adamant. And he goes, well, son, you're going to learn in life. Life isn't fair. And he walked away from me. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, he was right. But do you know who the jockey was he brought in?
That's what I'm curious. Who?
Jerry Bailey.
Yeah. I forgot he rode in Chicago.
Yep.
What a circuit Chicago is. I rode out there in 80 and 81, and I think back to some really fine racing at Arlington Park. I would only go out there for the Arlington Park meet. And it was just a great place to spend the summers, Arlington Park. And one year I was out there, Jerry left New York, and that's where he came in 81. And I guess it was to, like, rejuvenate his you know, he wasn't, I think he was on a little bit of a downslide in New York, and he came to Arlington in 81, I guess it was. And he got to rolling and rejuvenated his business and career out there, and I guess he went back to New York and never left again. So it's amazing how people, you know, have to manage your business. Like you were saying, it's hard to manage your business sometimes because it's hard to say no. Especially if it's to a guy that you feel like you're slighting because he doesn't have a bunch of horses or a bunch of winners behind his name. But riders, you know, you wind up putting your business in agents' hands. And at times you have to intervene, and sometimes you can't be the messenger, but your agent can. And I guess I'm laughing about it because in my career, I don't know how many different agents you had, but I counted them one day and I had 15 different agents and wrote a lot of years. But it seemed like I always had to get a new one because they were burning themselves out saying no for me at times in the later part of my career, because I couldn't say no, but I could say, hey, Rich, or hey, Joe, or hey, whoever my agent was at the time with that 15 of them, you got to get me off this horse, or you got to take care of this. And I managed my business to stay on the better one. And you know what? Even doing that, Rich, you wound up hitting the ground. And at the end, you know, my last years that I rode, the last 10 years, had my same amount of injuries that I did the first 10 years. So even managing your business, sometimes it's just things out there that you can't avoid, because horse racing, one thing about it, it's a great sport. It's a great sport for a young athlete or an old athlete. It's a great sport, but it does have a downside that it tests you. And you gotta live up to the test and endure. That's all you can do, Rich. Yeah. And let me just say one more thing. I appreciate you, race rider Richie. I appreciate the compliments today. And Steve, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. I'm going to free you up and let you go because I've been long-winded and I don't want to mess up the show up or your schedule. But Richie, I'll never forget what you said on the air today, and I thank you so much. And Richie, thank you, you race rider. Love you, brother. And
from the heart, Tony, from the heart.
And you know what? Jockeys are a brotherhood. And instead of just calling you a fellow race rider, I'm going to call you brother, because that's what jockeys wind up. You spend a lot of time in locker rooms together, and a lot of times your paths cross. Jockeys are a brotherhood. Take care, and yes, thank you for the time and the entertainment. Take care, guys. Bye.
All right, Tony, take care.
Tony Black, unbelievable. I when he texted Rich, I knew I had to patch him in. It just was a natural.
Oh, absolutely. I have so much, you know, admiration and respect for Tony. And I love listening to him. I love talking to him. I don't get to see him, you know, in person hardly ever. But, you know, he's just a tremendous guy. Tremendous guy. And, it's funny because I'm not in the car as much on weekdays right now, and that's when I get to listen to you. So I miss his segment
sure.
a lot now, but I got to make an effort, you know.
Pull up from Thursday because, and particularly because there's some names there that were somewhere unfamiliar to me from the early 80s. And, you know, I really did not start to follow closely until, you know, after I got out of college in 82 and then started going to, you know, to big events, notably in New York and to Preakness. And you're going to hear some names that you're going to, you know, say wow. But this was a lot of fun, and I there were some things I could have slipped in, especially with Smith's name coming up. You know, he managed to find a way to have money taken out of his pocket over the weekend, and we'll save that conversation.
Absolutely. And I mean, this was fun. This was great. And the one thing that kept coming back to me, because you come up with names and we talk about, you know, My Juliet and Broad Brush. Right? I won a grade one on Pompeii, who was by Broad Brush, and all these intersections of people and horses that we all somehow are connected to in some way. You know, Tony bringing up different names and going, yeah, you know, I rode with that guy, or, you know, different experiences you have with them. You know, the world is so big, but the racing world in some ways is so small.
Well said, and so true. I mean, it's a very, you know, interrelated community. It just, you know, and there's so many families. It just, there's nothing like it. It's a, you know, it's an anachronism. There's so many things about it that's just so incredibly unique, and that's why I think it's so much fun for, you know, for our audience or any, you know, anybody that reads and follows and you know, is intrigued by the game. It's so different, it's so foreign and unusual, and so it's all, you know, it's all fresh and just sort of amazing, I think, to so many people. That's what's great about it.
Greatest game played outdoors.
Exactly. And the greatest unscripted drama in sports, although it is the anniversary of Do You Believe in Miracles, 41 years ago today.
Wow. 41 years ago today? Wow.
Today, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I got a great. I won't tell it now, but I actually have a great story about that because the Colgate hockey. You know, I was the play-by-play man for Colgate hockey, and we were right in the middle of a three-game road trip as the Olympics were ending, or you know, while the hockey was being played, and we had tons of connections. I played against all those guys from BU in New Hampshire, and. Francis Roy, Cox and Gould, and Callahan and everybody. I mean, Arruzioni, all those guys. But we were sort of on a trip and following it. You know, we had transistor radios. It was ridiculous because, those games were played like at 11 o'clock in the morning. People think it was all prime time. No, it wasn't. It was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon or, it was such a different era. And, it's one of my people also forget that wasn't the gold medal game. They had to turn around and beat Sweden.
They're right. They had one more. I know everybody acts like that was it right there. But I mean, it was monumental beating the Russian team. But
yeah,
they
incredible.
Still had to finish the deal.
Exactly, Richie. Thanks so much. Tremendous hour plus, and we will connect next week, and we'll have lots of stakes action to. Dissect.
Well, see, that was great. I loved it, and I look forward to talking to you later.
Richard Migliori on your Twitter, everybody, and on your television, and on your simulcast, Fox, America's Day at the Races. Let's take a break. Come back for the last 45. Ed Seltzer is going to join us. We're going to talk breeding and his long, long, successful career around the game. Almost took two graded stakes on Saturday within an hour of each other. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee.